TexasObserver.org. You're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. This is a half-hour radio news show in which we ask the Texas Observer staff to take a break from writing and say things to you on the radio instead. This week, we've got Observer staff writer Patrick Michaels on the show. Hey, Patrick.
Hey, Jonathan.
Also with us is Chris Hooks, our politics writer, to discuss the Civil Rights Summit that's been going on here in Austin, Texas. Welcome, Chris.
Hey, man.
Later in the show, we'll be joined by Observer Managing Editor Brad Tyre and University of Texas at Austin Journalism Professor Robert Jensen to talk about the disappearance of investigative journalism.
But we're sitting right here.
I know, we're right here. Yeah, we'll have to hear what he has to say about that. What an interesting problem. But first, let's talk about the Civil Rights Summit. Chris, you've been attending. What are we missing, man?
Well, this is a 3-day event. It's commemorating the 50th anniversary of the Lyndon Johnson's passage of the Civil Rights Act. It's been quite a show. They've brought three former presidents in to speak and to kind of sanctify the legacy of Lyndon Johnson a little bit. They brought President Obama in today. George W. Bush is speaking later tonight after we're taping. It'll be interesting to see what he has to say. It's kind of been rare to see him come out since he left the White House.
Right.
But they've had a couple of days of panels touching on the legacy of the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act. The summit is kind of part of a multi-decade push by the Johnson family to kind of move the public imagination of Lyndon Johnson away from someone who was responsible for Vietnam and into someone who is responsible for his domestic agenda, which by a lot of measures is significant, one of the most significant domestic legacies of any American president.
So he had a whole bunch of presidents there the family did, to help the cause.
Sure, and it's interesting to see. They're all kind of there to talk up Johnson. I guess that's what ex-presidents do.
Democrats and Republicans alike.
The polite thing, yes. One Republican. And they're also there, kind of there to talk up their own legacies. That's been interesting to see. Jimmy Carter is kind of at a stage where he's happy to say whatever comes to mind, and he had a kind of
that must be refreshing.
Yes, had a kind of warm sit down, talked about his history with Lyndon Johnson and everything else.
What did he have to say?
He talked a little bit about his personal history. Involvement in the civil rights movement. He never met Johnson, but he was a fan of his. I suppose kind of had a strained relationship with his him politically, as a lot of Democrats did in the decade or two after Johnson was president. Clinton, interestingly, talked about himself for quite a bit of his speech. Was introduced by Vernon Jordan, who talked about some of the great accomplishments of Clinton's presidency and low unemployment and things which didn't have a great maybe relationship to the theme of the summit. But
while we're all here, let's just take a minute and thank Bill Clinton for being great.
Sure.
Right.
And President Obama, someone who has his own kind of strange relationship with Johnson's legacy. He's someone who has sometimes been compared unkindly to Johnson. Johnson, this kind of gregarious, strong alpha male type personality who is known to be a great kind of manipulator of Congress. And people have often said that that's Barack Obama lacks some of those talents. Barack Obama kind of laid out his own history of Johnson kind of compared some of his legislative achievements to Johnson's. Gave a kind of parallel story of who Johnson was.
Can you give us an example?
He laid out the way that the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, was passed, something that involved a great deal of horse trading and kind of coercion and some political tactics and methods that seem unpalatable. And it seemed clear that he was, although not explicitly, kind of drawing a parallel between what he had to do to get the Affordable Care Act passed in 2009 and the Civil Rights Act. Maybe implicitly saying that he was capable of those legislative feats as much as Johnson was.
Ah. And there was also the great laugh line that I read about. It was so widely repeated that the President Obama mentioned that Johnson, you know, when he passed, Johnson is famous as well for passing something that people describe as socialized medicine. And now here we are today saying the same thing.
Yeah. One of the few speakers to mention Johnson's passage of Medicare as something maybe also that kind of mirrored his own focus, social policy.
So I'm interested as well. I mean, just not having been on campus and kind of avoiding it for traffic reasons the last few days. Like, I look on Twitter and everyone is talking about it, and there's, you know, selfies of I'm with Representative John Lewis, and look who I'm in the same room with. Isn't this great? You know, being there, we talked a little bit before we started recording that the media center is sort of, you know, set aside, and you're not really in the thick of things. But what's the atmosphere like around campus for all this?
Sure. Well, it's... I've heard, although I haven't seen it myself, that there's a number of seats empty in the auditorium while these people are speaking, and they're empty because they were set aside for state legislators, and almost none of the Republicans, if not none of the Republicans, have showed up. So there's that. A great number of big-name state Democrats are there. Wendy Davis was there today. Senator Rodney Ellis has been there. And so, yeah, it's a kind of... an event for a lot of these big-name figures associated with Texas politics, formerly associated with Texas politics, and the Johnson family. It's a kind of tightly knit network. Outside the library, you've seen an effort on the part of a coalition of immigration reform advocates to mobilize around the event and to try to get some attention at this very widely publicized summit onto their issues. Last night, several UT students chained themselves to the campus's MLK statue with loudspeakers talking about the DREAM Act and their desire to have President Obama stop mass deportations by executive order, something that's been a hot-button subject. And this morning, they marched from the UT Tower past the MLK statue, where the people chained up were released, marched to the summit as the president was arriving in his motorcade, and the three of the people who chained themselves to the statue last night sat down in front of a row of police and got arrested. And it was a successful attempt maybe to bring some attention to their cause, but also a reminder that there are a lot of issues related to civil rights, human rights, that are not really being discussed at the summit. One of the people who was chained to the MLK statue actually disrupted a panel, I believe Tuesday, where San Antonio Mayor Julian Castro and Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour were speaking on immigration policy and made the same demand that Obama stop deportations by executive order.
It sounds like first, you know, the summit is getting a lot of credit for casting a wide net, and when they talk about like how they define civil rights and talking about not only the past of the civil rights movement but also where we are today. But there are still some things when you've got President Obama around and a lot of political leaders who are still in office that some of the speakers are a little bit squeamish about bringing up too directly.
Sure. One journalist brought attention to the fact that before these speeches, they show slideshows of public demonstrations and civil disobedience, and at the same time, they strictly prohibit, at the threat of prosecution, anyone from engaging in that while the speeches are going on.
It was so right. Much more quaint when it was black and white, and it was all 50 years ago. And
sure. Yeah.
So mission accomplished.
Yes. So yeah, anytime you get you know, four presidents together, end up doing certain things to protect their public image, probably right. As a condition of them coming. So. Yeah, they've talked a little bit about immigration, talked about it on a political level, not so much on a policy level, and they had a panel on gay marriage. But apart from that, the focus has been very much on the past and not the future or the present.
Well, Chris, thanks for filling us in on the summit.
Sure.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show from the folks at the Texas Observer. Earlier this week, the debate over whether or not to develop an elective in Mexican-American history came to a head at a State Board of Education hearing. Patrick, what was the catalyst for this elective, and how has the debate developed?
Sure. Well, covering the State Board of Education, you get used to the sort of seasonal tides of controversy at the board, and every decade or so they rewrite the state standards for, you know, kindergartners to 12th graders on anything from science to social studies to math to whatever. And of course it's the science standards, usually the parts about evolution and climate change.
I've heard about that.
Right. And yeah, we've talked about that on the program here.
We have.
And then social studies standards, you know, related to anything in U.S. history or world history and who gets included and who doesn't and whose history is the history that we want to teach everyone's kids. That gets debated as well when they rewrite those standards. And they also do the same thing when they're rewriting, when they're adopting new textbooks. The same thing of who's in the textbook, who's not. Is the textbook skewed? Is it not? We just recently did the textbooks for science. We're going to do the textbooks for social studies later this year. And that's usually, you know, apart from that, the state board kind of operates quietly and not a lot of people pay attention to what's going on. This controversy over teaching Mexican-American studies came up kind of outside of that cycle last fall when Ruben Cortez, who's a state board member from Brownsville and a Democrat, sort of got the idea, and it wasn't just his idea. There was an activist named Tony Diaz, who we'll talk about in a minute, from Houston, who was really pushing for this. But the state board got the chance to write a wish list of new courses to teach in high school now that there's a little more room to have electives in the high school curriculum,
cool,
which is a new development. And so, you know, they're listing what kinds of new math classes do you want, what types of career and technical classes do you want. And Cortez said, well, hey, I'd like to add to our wish list a course on Mexican-American history. And there's a little bit of conversation, but at the time it was sort of like making a list. We're going to make a list, and then state staff is going to come up with the standards for it, and then we'll figure it out. And it all happened really quickly and quietly, and at the time it was kind of a surprise because these sorts of things usually are so contentious on the state board and are the result of years and years of wrangling and bringing in experts and not such experts to, you know, weigh in and you know, have their say. And then it all gets voted about and we all end up on Comedy Central because it's just so embarrassing.
Right.
So
thanks, John Stewart.
Right. So in the months since then, though, there's been sort of the familiar activists have noticed what was happening here and got ready for this fight, which came this week over a vote on creating this course. And so there are a bunch of Tea Party groups that wanted to not have this course in Mexican-American studies. And since this thing happened quietly, some of the state's bigger Hispanic groups and 50 state lawmakers and the teachers union in the state, Houston ISD's board, a few other school boards, all came out in support of this thing. You know, what was kind of a quiet thing at first became something with more familiar sort of battle lines. On Tuesday, there was a lot of public testimony in favor of the course and students coming up and saying, you know, if I had been able to learn about Mexican-American history, you know, being a Mexican-American myself, you know, that would give me some more buy-in in the school system. I would be able to sort of have a better connection to what I'm learning in class,
right,
and make it more relevant to me. And that was the argument for it. You know, as is often the case with the state board, the political fight is sort of happening at a really high level with a lot of angry talk. And what actually would change based on what they're voting on is in this case, pretty small. So creating this new course, it would be, you know, school districts can teach whatever they want already.
Right.
They can teach a new course if a teacher wants to teach it. What this would be is a signal from the state saying we're sanctioning this elective and specifically Mexican-American studies. Probably there would be more districts that would feel able to teach it.
It wouldn't be like an enforced requirement.
Right. They wouldn't even have to offer the class, let alone, you know, have students forced to take it.
And it would be sanctioned.
Right. And you'd also have like probably another one of these really ugly debates on the state board about, you know, where you have, you know, all of the state board members fighting over who gets included in a course on Mexican-American history.
Right.
You know, it's kind of a joke, but also a painful moment. Ken Mercer, the state board member from San Antonio, you know, wondered if his two favorite U.S. senators, Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, would be included in this Mexican-American history course.
Right.
They are Cuban-American.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was some tittering from the audience over that. But the point, I think, is who gets to decide who gets to be even in a course like this. What happened instead, there was no vote on creating the course in Mexican-American history. At the last minute, probably sensing that he didn't have the votes to get this thing passed, Cortez sort of switched and decided to propose soliciting a new textbook, basically like offering a chance for the state to put a stamp of approval on a Mexican-American history textbook for schools to use instead of creating a new class.
I gotta say, man, that seems a lot like passing the buck.
Well, sure. But I mean, no one would have to take this class if it was created anyway. No one would have to offer it. So what supporters of this effort have been saying is, you know, really either way, it's a win. You know, Tony Diaz, who led an effort to import banned books into Mexico on Mexican-American studies.
Into Arizona.
And I'm sorry.
Right.
Yeah.
It's called Libro Traficante.
That's it. Yeah. And we've written about him in The Observer before. He's the guy who created this more recent effort on Mexican-American studies here in Texas in this specific, you know, iteration. And he was pretty happy with what happened. He was like, hey, now we got a book. We didn't have a book before. And the proposal includes not only a book on Mexican-American studies, but Asian-American, Native American, and African-American studies as well.
Yeah, let's be inclusive.
So, you know, there was also some talk on the board like, hey, who are we leaving out if we're just going to focus on Mexican-American studies? And this way, you know, everybody's happy. What they did is they also avoided having, you know, some real talk on the state board about why Mexican-American history is, like, uniquely important to Texas history.
Right.
And why, you know, that you know, is something that students should be exposed to, especially.
Real quick, what's likely to happen next?
So we're recording this on Thursday.
Yeah.
The vote to approve the textbooks was a preliminary vote. They're going to vote for the final time on Friday. So nothing's for sure, but if it passes then in July, the board's going to come back and they're going to sort of, make some tweaks to the selective course that the books would get, to sort of, beef it up as a delivery device for ethnic studies, in schools.
Cool. Thanks for sharing that story. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour radio news show from the folks at the Texas Observer. Robert Jensen recently reviewed The Watchdog That Didn't Bark for TexasObserver.org. The book by Dean Starkman examines the economic meltdown of the 2000s and its impact on investigative journalism. Here to discuss the book are Observer Managing Editor Brad Tyer and UT Journalism Professor Robert Jensen. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Well, first of all, thanks, Bob, for being here. A frequent contributor to The Observer. Maybe not frequent enough, but we'll try and get more stuff out of you.
Frequent contributor and always loyal reader.
Long-time listener,
first-time
caller.
And subscriber, right? Too. Very important.
So I was excited to have you take a look at this book, The Watchdog That Didn't Bark. Let's start with the metaphor of the title. This is a book about the failures of investigative journalism during the financial crisis. And the author, Dean Starkman, to my understanding, you've read the book. I've only glanced at it. Relies on this metaphor that we've all heard of and probably have used at The Observer of watchdog journalism, accountability journalism versus access journalism. You didn't particularly have a problem with the book with what it is, but I think you have an issue with the metaphor of watchdog journalism. Can you tell us about that a little bit?
Right. So the metaphor of journalist as watchdog has been with us for more than a century now. It suggests that in a well-functioning democratic system, you need an external check on power, and journalists can perform that. They can be a watchdog to abuses within the system. It assumes that the system itself is functional, and that's what I was taking issue with, that in a healthy system, there will be abuses, and looking out for those would be adequate. But I think that the evidence we have in front of us now is that our economic system, our political system, our social system, and its effect on the overarching ecosystems that our own lives depend on is not so functional. And so I'm suggesting that instead of simply being a watchdog, barking at the abuses within the system, journalists have to start thinking about being able to step back and make a more fundamental critique of the systems themselves. And of course, at the heart of that would be a fundamental critique of capitalism. So Dean Starkman, who comes out of a very traditional journalism career and was quite successful, investigative reporter, The Wall Street Journal, now an editor at Columbia Journalism Review, he's kind of the best of the best of mainstream journalism. And the review really asks, is that enough? Mm-hmm. Maybe at one point it was. But I think clearly, as we face multiple cascading crises in this world, that's not all we should be asking from journalism.
Not enough. Does there remain a function for watchdog-style journalism?
Sure. I mean, a healthy system, social system, journalistic system, political system is kind of like an ecosystem. Diverse systems tend to be more healthy. So if we had a media system in which there were watchdogs, people who saw their mission as basically keeping existing systems and the people who run them, politicians, corporate executives, that sort of thing, keeping them honest, that would be all to the good. If there were also very serious journalists making those more fundamental critiques. And implicit in what I was writing is that we don't have enough of those. You know, often people look at the two professions I've been a part of in my life. I've been a working journalist and I've been an academic. Mm-hmm. And people often think, well, these are very, you know, hotbeds of radicalism. And while you can go to places like The Observer and see a political critique, in virtually all of journalism and much of the modern academy, they aren't hotbeds of radicalism. They're very conventional spaces. And so if we don't have some place from which there is emanating a good, consistent, radical critique of these systems, I think these multiple cascading crises I'm talking about are only going to get worse. I know that's a difficult argument to make at a time when almost everybody seems afraid of the word radical, mm-hmm. when a mainstream centrist Democrat like Barack Obama is painted as a socialist. I mean, it's almost like we live in a kind of funhouse mirror world. But all the more reason, I think, to articulate these more radical critiques and defend them. And I think they are, in fact, very defensible.
Mm-hmm. One of the things, we had some, there was some response to the review, which is always good to get. Some of the responders had some difficulty with the idea of what this more fundamental critique-oriented journalism might look like. Typically, that critique was couched in, oh, sure, so every piece of journalism, every record review, is going to end up being a essential critique of capitalism. As I understand it, that's not actually your argument. But to follow that thread for a little bit, do we have a model of what the journalism that you're asking for would look like?
Well, one model might be the early American journalism. Mm-hmm. In some ways, the first most important and most glorious of American journalists was probably Tom Paine. Tom Paine came over from England. The first article Tom Paine wrote for a newspaper when he landed in what was to become the United States, was a critique of slavery. He was, of course, most famous for Common Sense, which was, in a sense, an act of journalism of its day, making a very important argument for independence from Great Britain. So there is, in the United States, a deep and rich history of a more politicized journalism. I'm not saying we need to go back to the 18th century. That's not very viable. But you can see across many societies, including the United States historically, times when this notion of an objective, neutral journalism, which I believe is a fallacy, that neutrality is never actually achievable. You're always working from some sort of assumptions, political assumptions, economic assumptions, mm-hmm. and it's better to make them evident, to bring them up to the surface and make them transparent. All neutral journalism does is tend to go with the flow of the existing system of power. So you can look at Western Europe, where they've had much more ideological, politicized journalism, and it didn't, you know, fall into nothing but, you know, crazy rants about politics. Journalists can have politics that inform their reporting, be open and honest about those political frameworks, and still good reporting, that is reporting based on empirical evidence. Mm-hmm. The Observer does that. The Observer doesn't hide its political slant. It's a liberal magazine, often associated with a certain approach in the Democratic Party, increasingly rare in Texas. But the reporting in The Observer is based on good reporting. It's folks going out and doing the work. I have friends all over the world in journalism. I was just on the phone yesterday with one of the top journalists in India who has a very clear critique of multinational corporations and their role in the Indian economy, their effect on farmers. Yet his reporting is based on the hard work of going out into the villages, you know, doing the ground, on the ground reporting. So this idea that somehow being open and honest about a political ideology that informs your reporting is mutually exclusive with real reporting is simply defied by our own experience in the U.S. and I think experiences all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We are now, American journalism at least, is going through a period of pretty profound questioning, looking for a business model. We've had a couple of hundred years of an advertising model that's changing, yeah. if not going out the door. And we also, I think, have a journalism ecosystem that's increasingly populated, you could argue, by young folks right out of college who might not necessarily be in the best position to make fundamental critiques, informed fundamental critiques of existing systems. Is there an opportunity at this historical moment in journalism, as we search for a new business model, as the business models change, to work some of the type of critique you're talking about back into the field?
Sure. Let's remember that the business model for American journalism has actually varied over time. Originally, American journalism was largely subsidized by political parties and to a large degree by the government. Bob McChesney, a great scholar, has made the point that early American journalism, especially through lower postal rates, essentially newspapers and magazines being delivered for free, was highly subsidized by the government. Early editors had printing contracts with the government that effectively were a subsidy. So the advertising model comes in the 19th, especially the late 19th century. It's not the only way to organize a press, even in the U.S. I don't pretend to have a crystal ball. I'm not even sure I understand what's going on in journalism today, let alone predict it for tomorrow. It is true that the changes in the digital journalism are not all positive. I think the principle we want to keep in mind is a journalism that is independent from any other source of power, whether it's the government or advertisers or people who fund it philanthropically, that no system of funding journalism in the modern industrial world is going to be perfect. Mm-hmm. Again, I go back to a diversity. If we have journalism that comes in the traditional advertising-supported model, a capitalist journalism in a sense, if we have philanthropically supported journalism, if the government gets involved and subsidizes, not controls, but helps subsidize citizen and activist journalism, mm-hmm. I think we can get an ecosystem that produces the kind of mix we want to reinvigorate politics, because all of this matters, not just because you and I are journalists or I teach journalism, but because an independent journalism is essential to democracy. And mm-hmm. I think this is in the interests of everybody, citizens, no matter what their political slant.
Okay. Jonathan, I see you nodding. Are we out of time there?
We are out of time.
This is a criminally short discussion of a long book and a large topic. I think we can safely recommend the book on its own terms for what it is, The Watchdog That Didn't Bark, and also highly recommend Professor Jensen's piece in the Texas Observer. You can find it online. Thanks for being with us today.
It was great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks both of you.
We've unfortunately reached the end of this episode, but before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music, and of course, a big thanks to all of you out there listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at the lovely Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Scholes. For more Texas news and culture, visit us on the web at texasobserver.org, or you can pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk at you again next time on Observer Radio.